Welcome to I Want That, which is an ongoing series here at the Jim Hill Media Podcast Network, a show that focuses on the dynamic world of Disney merch. I'm entertainment writer Jim Hill.
And I'm entertainment writer Michelle Valladolid.
And we're recording this on Wednesday, March 4th, 2020. Now, I know it's been a while since we recorded a podcast. In fact, the last one was posted in January this year. And I want to stress, this was not Michelle's fault. If you've been listening to any of the other shows that posted Podcast Network, you know that I was battling a cold, one that hung on for the better part of a month. And just want to say I'm 90% back, folks, which means hopefully I'll no longer sound like I'm talking out on nostril, which I know it's kind of gross. A lot of merch news has broken since Michelle and I last did a show, so let's get to it. But before we get started, I want to remind our listeners that I Want That is brought to you by Storybook Destination, trusted travel partner of the Jim Hill Media Podcast Network. For a worry-free travel experience every time, book online at storybookdestinations.com. Okay, now to the news. What's your take, Michelle? I mean, obviously, a lot of big news has broken over the last couple of weeks. I mean, Bob Iger steps down as head of the Walt Disney Company. Bob Chapek assumes the throne.
On Biz Twitter, they're acting like it's the second coming of Paul Pressler. I disagree.
Okay, and that's a smart attitude. If I were picking the biggest story, I think it's to be honest, the impact the coronavirus is having. Let's see. We have first saw Shanghai Disneyland close on January 25th, and the very next day, the Hong Kong Disneyland Resort closed. And just this past, Saturday, they announced that the Tokyo Disney Resort would be closing, but it only closed for two weeks. That's right.
Okay. I think it might stretch out further than that. Mm-hmm. I think it might go to 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. And the reason is why is because a couple days ago, they said 6 weeks was the point at which people could, you know, go home, and numbers of infected were dwindling in China.
And given that the Louvre actually closed in Paris on March 1st, that's the number three tourist attraction in France. Like, I think Eiffel Tower is number two, and of course, number one is Disneyland Paris.
Hooray for our team.
Yeah. So a lot of people are asking, you know, is Disneyland Paris going to close? And the interesting thing is the resort has issued a statement which reads, Disneyland Paris is open and welcomes its guests as usual. However, they noted that we are following the development of the situation in close collaboration with health authorities, whose recommendations we follow. They then go on to say, you can check our park hours at this hour, and that seems to be, maybe you should update that, you know, just to make drop by every day and check that one out. To double back to the Tokyo Disney resorts and this closure, do you think this is going to impact the Disney Easter thing? Now, I know on an earlier I Want That, you and I went into great length about all the special merch and, you know, they do for this annual fest, which is scheduled this year from March 27th through June 12th, right?
Correct.
Okay. Now, out ahead of this week's show, you did your due diligence and went down to Little Tokyo in LA and picked up a copy of Disney Fan Magazine. They have a lot of coverage of what's to come, right, for this year's Disney Easter celebration, which, again, as I understand it, the dates are March 27th through June 12th.
You're right. They've got a good 10 pages dedicated just to Easter goods and foods and things like that. And they have a parade, they've got photo ops, and they've got a show.
They, of course, have some of the great merch on the planet. In fact, I think previously we stated unspoken Disney truth that, you know, that everything's better in Japan. Can you talk except a little bit about, you know, some of the pieces that are being done for this year's Disney Easter celebration at the parks there?
Well, they've got, I mean, everything. They've got hairbands and socks and shirts and baby stuff and really cute hoodie. And one of my favorites is the sleeping, you know, like the sleeping Figment and the sleeping Pooh and all those. They have a sleeping Usapio, which is the mascot for their Easter stuff. It's a chick with bunny ears and a little cracked egg on the top of his head. And because chicks go pew, pew in Japan. Mm-hmm. There's a keychain set, and it's plush keychains. Mm-hmm. It is $21, and it's the Fab Four, I guess you'd say, Mickey, Minnie, Donald, and Goofy. They're each holding a little P.O., and they're all dressed in their Easter best. In fact, Goofy has eggs on his pants. He has pants on his eggs.
You know, here in the States, when we think Easter, we think Easter baskets. They have something like that, or?
They do. They have a really cute Disney Easter 2020 basket with P.O. in it, and flowers around the edge, and that's $30.
Finally, of course, it's Easter, you know, and for some odd reason, we think chocolate.
Oh, yeah, they've got all sorts of tins and boxes and even a stuffed P.O. head. But my favorite, there's a metal Easter egg. Very, very designed. And it's got the Fab Five on it, including Pluto, with designs of them as eggs. With little egg-shaped designs of them. It's really cute. And on the inside, there's individually wrapped chocolate eggs with a Mickey head silhouette on it.
Tokyo Disneyland, as of right now, is only closed, well, again, got closed on February 29th, and is scheduled to reopen March 15th. But as Michelle just mentioned, given the coronavirus-related situation, that this may be extended. But it's also important to remember that it's not like Tokyo Disneyland hasn't closed before. In fact, you know, how many of you remember the Tohoku earthquake and tsunami that happened back March 11th, 2011? Now, that was a Friday, and the quake happened at 2:46 in the afternoon in Japan, and Tokyo Disney Seas and Tokyo Disneyland were both open at the time. There were 70,000 guests in the park at that time, Michelle, and now couldn't go home because of all of Japanese transportation systems shut down for post-quake safety checks. Plus, there was the matter of the aftershocks.
Right.
The first week after the quake, there were 315 aftershocks, some of them as high as magnitude 5.0. And to put that in perspective, the original earthquake, which happened off the coast of Japan under the sea, that was estimated to be magnitude 9.1. Now, you've seen the Imagineering Story documentary series that Leslie Iwerks did, right?
Right. Oh, yeah.
Okay. So I think it's episode 5, which is entitled Carousel of Progress, that actually has footage of the quake happening in the park.
Yeah.
What's weird is that there's these images of water coming up out of the ground because, of course, Tokyo Disney Resort is built on landfill, on reclaimed land at the edge of Tokyo Harbor. And so I guess What's that called? Liquefaction, when the water comes up through the reclaimed land?
Yeah.
Okay. But the thing I love about that footage is they show how the Tokyo Disney cast members went above and beyond to care for these 70,000 people who actually had to stay overnight in the park before, I guess, it was then deemed safe that they could, you know, start to go to their cars or get in the transportation systems and head up. But anyway, the two Tokyo Disney parks then stayed closed up until April 28th of that year, which is just ahead of something called Golden Weeks. Mm-hmm. What
Golden
is that?
Week. Golden Week is when everybody takes the week off to visit relatives or go on trips or celebrate.
Got it. Okay. So long story short, you know, the Tokyo Disney Resort's Easter celebration has been disrupted before, folks. So it's no biggie this time around. Michelle gets to go to L.A.'s Little Tokyo when she's doing research for I Want That. Some of us don't get to go to cool places like that. Me, I went to the Merrimack Premium Outlets, which is this outdoor mall in southern New Hampshire, just 16 miles up from the Massachusetts border. Anyway, I dropped by there on February 28th. That was a Friday. We were shopping for Nancy's grandnephew, Abraham. He's going to turn 2 in a week or two. And you know, it kind of kills me because he's just been introduced to Winnie the Pooh and has fallen in love with the character Tigger. So we pick up a plush. And it's only when we get home that we find out that on February 29th, the Disney stores, in honor of Leap Day, offered a 29% off discount on all Tigger plush. Because, of course, you know, it's Leap Day. And so it's like, I don't know.
Timing is everything, Jim.
You know, I'm not a very smart guy. Maybe if I bought more of that Disney wisdom stuff that, again, we talked about in an earlier.
I don't think that'd be wise, Jim.
The Disney wisdom stuff, at least based the stuff that's been remaindered at the Disney store that, again, we have at the Merrimack Premium Outlets, that stuff's been marked down by 40%, which suggests that maybe that didn't sell all that well, which again kind of puzzled me because Disney is doing it again. They've got a brand new come in the third Saturday of every month collection thing going. Have you heard about this? The main attraction?
Oh, yeah, I love those. I love the Space Mountain one.
Yeah, can you describe that? It's the very first plush that they sold in January.
She's kind of purplish, mm-hmm. and she's got stars and galaxies on her ears, and her mm-hmm. skirt is Space Mountain with the ridges and everything.
Yeah, and that's kind of the gimmick for this particular collection. That every month they're going to celebrate. A classic deemed Disney theme park attraction. So, what is it? For February, they did Pirates of the Caribbean, and you and I were talking about that earlier. You know, her outfit is, this time around, is like Buccaneer Gold.
Right, exactly.
Back
and Spanish lace.
For March, she's celebrating the Mad Tea Party. And they've got a full set of items this time around. They've got the plush doll that goes for $29.99. There's also a mini backpack that Loungefly is doing. A different one every month, and those go for $90 a piece.
Yeah, that's Loungefly prices. Mm-hmm.
And if you happen to be down at Walt Disney World when, the latest mini, the main attraction is introduced, they also offer a magic band that its design sort of keys off of that attraction, that's $34.99. And then there's a stackable mug for $19.99, a set of Minnie Mouse ear, the headband thing, that also goes to $34.99. And finally, a pin set, which features three limited release pins every month, that's also $19.99. I have to warn you, if you're a completist, grabbing every item for Minnie Mouse's The Main Attraction collection every month is going to get pricey. It's $240 plus tax. Again, not to sort of rub salt in the wound of Disney Wisdom collection stuff being remaindered. I'm going to just now selling for roughly 60% of what it sold last year. When you and I were talking earlier about this, Michelle, you were advising folks not to think of these as investments, but to just really get the, if you like what you see, and you're fond of a particular attraction or you're fond of a particular plush, buy it for that reason. Don't buy it because, you think at some point you're going to be able to put your kids through school selling this stuff. I think that's a smart way to approach Disney collecting. Get what appeals to you rather than thinking, speaking of which, there's a lot of folks right now who are just getting started sort of wandering around Epcot for the very first, this year's Flower and Garden Festival, which starts today, March 4th, and runs through June 1st, not 21st. Not saying that Michelle and I are old, but we actually went to, we lived in Orlando back in, starting in 1993. So we were there for the very first Flower and Garden Festival. In fact, I think it ran right after Alice was born,
right? Yeah, she was like 2 months old.
Yeah. And do you remember anything particular from the first Flower and Garden?
I remember walking around World Showcase and seeing how pretty the topiaries were.
Yeah, and you were just talking about how you looked at some of the topiaries for 2020 and really enjoyed those as well.
The Peter Pan one's very impressive. His face sculpt, I don't know what you call it with plants, but it is right on. And they just unveiled a Snow White and Dopey that are great, and a Remy from Ratatouille, the rat.
Mm-hmm.
Really cute.
And you were also eyeballing some of the merch that's been created. Like, for example, there's the World in Bloom collection?
There is the World in Bloom collection, and that features Minnie and flowers, and it's really, really cute. And it actually reminds me of a set that I had back when we were married where I had the whole clothing set and the hat with Minnie and the floral stuff. Except this is a much more stylized Minnie. Alice has a cup that we got on the cruise line with this same stylized Minnie, and she's just gorgeous.
And weren't you telling me that there was a coffee mug that you, or a coffee cup that you particularly enjoyed?
There are coffee mugs that look like flower pots, but there are also coffee mugs that look like glazed watering cans.
And how are we supposed to drink our coffee out of the watering can?
Any way you like.
That's okay. Let's see. Also, you talked about the Mickey's Farmer's Market collection.
The Mickey's Farmer's Market collection is really cute. It's got Mickey, like the flower pot cup that I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. And he's carrying vegetables, and the handle is an ear of corn.
Mm-hmm.
There's also one with metal. Mm-hmm. And it's
Okay, so the Mickey's Farmer's Market collection had a keychain you particularly liked?
Yeah, it's a Mickey. It's metal. Mm-hmm. It's Mickey's head, and it's surrounded by canned and preserved goods, which it sounds so strange. I know it sounds so strange, but it's really, really cute. And then there's a homegrown hat that has Spaceship Earth Mickey and his basket of vegetables.
Okay. But I think you said your favorite of the offerings from the merch point of view.
Orange Bird.
Again, the guy, the character that just defeats me. I don't understand the appeal, but this is the Orange Bird
Hello like Anita Bryant.
Sunshine collection. Is that correct?
Hello, Sunshine. Hello, Sunshine. Mm-hmm. It's there's a mini ears that have his head on one side and Hello Sunshine on the other, and the bow is green like an orange tree with pretty little orange blossoms sprinkled over it.
Okay. And well, I
you know, there's an Aloha shirt. There is a spirit jersey.
Okay.
What were you saying before I interrupted?
Well,
you?
I don't know. Again, you know, you have Orange Rudy, but if I had to pick a character that's featured at this year's Flower and Garden that I'd be intrigued in chasing merch down from, it's the, what is it, Spike's Cute as Can Be, and that's BEE collection.
Yeah. Get down here. Yes.
This all keys off of what? The Spike character that I guess was introduced in a Donald Duck cartoon, Window Cleaner, back from 1940.
Correct.
It's a cute little bee character, and he wound up being featured in like 13 different shorts that Disney produced over the years. In fact, there's one in there called, what, Beezy Bear from 1955 that stars my favorite Humphrey, which I have to go chase down, but So what is in the Cute as Can Be collection?
There is a stake, you know, like you stick in your garden with him on a sunflower. Mm-hmm. There is a really cute picnic blanket that looks like a messenger bag because it's got the tote and it hangs over, but then it unfolds into this really cool picnic blanket. And there's an ornament and there's a shirt. And then there's the annual pass holder collection.
You're excited about this one because this one, Figment, yeah. But if you were also mentioning that you think the big, highly sought after toy from this year's Flower and Garden, it is going to be one of the wishables.
Right. There's a Mickey, there's a Minnie, there's either a cup or a bowl of something that's adorable. Mm-hmm. There's a butterfly, and then the one I think is going to be the breakout is the topiary Figment. It's a green plant Figment with little leaves all over it.
Oh, that does sound cool. We were just talking about Spike the Bee, who, again, you know, given the debut in back in 1940, is celebrating his 80th anniversary at the Walt Disney Company. And it's worth noting that today is actually today, March 4th, is the 70th anniversary of Cinderella's release in theaters back in 1950. It's hard to understate how important Cinderella was to the Walt Disney Company. I mean, without all of the money that smash hit made, I mean, that was the seed money for Disneyland. So it's kind of appropriate that Disney Store has what they're calling a Cinderella and Carriage deluxe gift set. What's kind of cool about this thing is that it has a Cinderella in her classic blue dress with removable blue glass slippers. It also has, a pumpkin coach that can light up from within. And it even has a white horse with rooted hair in its mane and its tail. And what's kind of fun about it is that it has a bridle and a harness that can be removed. So you can, play with it away from the carriage. The only problem, for me with this 70th anniversary collectible is its price point, which is $79.95, which seems a trifle steep for me for a toy you should be getting for a kid.
Well, if your daughter was 4 and she wanted it.
Ah, okay.
Am I wrong?
All right, you're not wrong.
I'm not wrong.
Now, speaking of Cinderella, the Magic Happens Parade debuted at Disneyland Park back just this past Friday, February 28th. And while Cinderella isn't in the parade, it's first daytime parade Disney's had in brand new daytime parade Disney's had in years, but her fairy godmother is in it, though I guess from what you were hearing, it's not that fairy, that fairy character that people are talking about, but it's rather
Aurora. Her dress goes from Rose, pink to blue. Aurora.
Yeah, what's that about?
It's the special material. It's kind of like the Autopia cars, and it, as the light hits it, it goes from pink to blue and back.
Okay. So, and I think you were saying that you anticipate that Disneyland will eventually put out some merch related to Magic Happens that duplicates this effect, right?
They have plenty of merchandise out now, but I really think that with all the buzz that dress has been promoting online, I think that it would be smart of them to put out some merchandise that does that same color shift.
Well, can we talk about some of the merchandise they actually have put out for Magic Happens?
Oh, yeah. Oh. They've got some great mouse ears that has the logo and the main thing on the parade is this big purple sorcerer's hat with swirls on it. Mm-hmm. So they've got mouse ears with that, and they're fuzzy. Mm-hmm. That's $29.99. Yeah. There's a really great raglan shirt that I love. It's kind of plain for most people. It's gray, and it's got purple sleeves. It's got Mickey down near the waist, and then over the heart it says Magic Happens. I love it. I think it's great. It's $36.99. There is a light-up tumbler that's a lot like that famous Epcot tumbler with the straw, and that's $19.99. And again, the hat is on top of that.
Okay.
There is a light-up ornament. It's one of those big mouse ear, Mickey Mouse-shaped ones. It's purple. And then there's a limited release pin that's $15.99. And there's a pass holder exclusive pen that's $17.99. Oh, and the ornament is $27.99.
This merch is only available in Disneyland Park, right? Though I guess some of it might eventually show up at the World of Disney out in the Downtown Disney area. I bring this up because I wonder how many of our listeners have actually made it to one of those Disney stores that were supposed to be built in side of Target.
I'm
remember
still
this
waiting.
Announcement. Yeah. I guess it was back in October of last year. They announced they were going to build 25 of these.
Bob Chapek announced it at D23.
Well, I guess it was Target that, then announced that, specifically there were going to be these first 25 at select Targets around the country. What was interesting, they were going to be 750 square foot stores. They were going to be some 450 items on display in these stores. But what was kind of interesting is at least 100 of these items were going to be things that you'd only previously been able to get in an official Disney store or at the Disney parks. So, again, the reason I'm kind of putting this out there is that I wonder if any of our listeners have actually been to one of these, these Disney stores within a Target. I was trying to get to one myself, but, the closest one to me is in the Pocono Commons shopping mall, which is in Stroudburg, Pennsylvania.
And you're in New Hampshire.
Yeah, that's a bit of a schlep.
That's a little bit, yeah.
I dropped by my local Target and to get a check to see if we make the list. But To be honest, lately, the only thing I've seen there Disney-related is kind of interesting. They've begun doing some sales of sorts for the Frozen 2 items.
You mean like clearance sales?
It's not panic discounting. I mean, for example, they're selling these Anna and Elsa costumes that key off of the outfits that the sisters wore in Frozen 2. So they have, for example, Elsa's dark sea dress that initially went for $39.99. It's now selling for $35.99. And the wig that goes with this particular outfit, you know, originally sold for $19.99, now dropping to $16.99. And then there's a set of boots. Those have dropped from $16.99 to $15.29. So given that we're way far away from Halloween, I get why they would be, you know, marking that down a little. But let's be honest, you know, Frozen 2 just arrived on store shelves. What is it? Just this past week, the Blu-ray and DVD.
Yeah, so there should be a bump in the merchandise.
That's what I was thinking as well. In fact, what's also kind of interesting is that if you walk around, getting into the toy aisle, there's actually a promotion that Frozen, you know, the Target's doing now for Disney Frozen items, that if you buy $40 worth of this merch, they'll then give you a $10 gift card. And similarly, if you wander over to the Lego aisle, they're doing if you buy $50 worth of Lego Star Wars toys, they'll give you a free $10 gift card. So, and given that you know, the Rise of Skywalker doesn't hit Blu-ray and DVD till the tail end of this month, you got to assume, as we were just talking about, that Blu-ray DVD will spur a second round of toy sales.
Right.
On the other hand, I have to admit, it was kind of an eye-opener to take a look at what some of these Lego sets were going for. I mean, I know you're a big Kylo Ren fan.
I am.
But, you know, they have this amazingly detailed version of Kylo Ren's shuttle that goes for $129.99.
Yep.
You know, but again, that seems
so
a downright bargain.
So Junior can get out his pocket change and go buy himself a Lego. Legos are pricey.
I guess that's the thing. We had a girl, so I guess I dodged the Lego bullet. But
oh, no, I didn't dodge the Lego bullet. I still have marks on my feet.
Okay, well, all right. You know, again, that $129 Kylo Ren shuttle looks positively affordable next to the $159 Millennium Falcon, which, by the way, to be fair,
there's an $800 Millennium Falcon, $799.99.
Okay. I guess, long story short, you know, I was just whining about the $79 that, you know, for that Cinderella and Carriage Deluxe gift playset. So
you were adorable while you did it.
Yeah, all right, but again, it's you know, I mean, that's the thing in the world of retail. You know, when a movie underperforms at the box office, you know, the toys suffer, you know, and, oh boy, you know, that's, you know, when we get back from our break, we're going to talk about the Disney movie that's infamous even today for the way it did not sell toys.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And we're back, before we get to that movie with the toys that didn't sell, again, it's March 4th, and we have to, you know, let people know that today, Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway officially opened at Disney's Hollywood Studios.
And it's going to be quite the people eater.
You know, the one complaint they're hearing from folks is that, you know, the real problem with Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway is that it isn't the great movie ride.
That's really, that's the only. Know. Oh, and there's a scene in the pre-show where Minnie does a pirouette and accidentally kicks Pluto into the car, and then without knowing he was there, puts the luggage on him and closes the door. It's done for slapstick, but some people are making a big deal out of it.
Well, you know, that's there are people who would complain if they were hung with a new rope. For me, what I'm enjoying of what I've seen so far of this brand new Disney's Hollywood Studio attraction is, well, first of all, it seemed to do such a wonderful job of recreating the world from Paul Rudder's shorts. These brand new Mickey Mouse cartoons
that have been out there. Chris Willis did the music
for the ride. Well, yeah, Christopher Willis, who, you know, did such a great job on the music for the shorts. But, you know, and for me, it's just kind of startling that it's only been since March of 2013 that you know, these wonderful shorts have been out there. Face it. It must have been tough to be saddled with the assignment to, you know, effectively not only replace the great movie ride, but also figure out a way to bring these wonderful stylized Mickey Mouse shorts into the world, into a 3D environment. But, you know, thank God somebody at Disney was smart enough to hand off this project to Kevin Rafferty. How long have we known Kevin at this point?
Since the Sunny Eclipse days, when Alice loved Sunny Eclipse. She was about two, I think.
Wow. Yeah, so 1996. Wow.
Okay. I sent him a drawing that she made of Sunny Eclipse, and he sent back an autographed picture from Sunny Eclipse. He knows him well.
Okay, cool. I guess the biggest indication that Disney thinks they have a smash hit on their hands is the virtual mountain of Mickey and Minnie Runaway Railway merch.
There is a ton.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk us through it?
Oh, yeah. There's an opening day pin, a pass holder shirt, a railroad engineer hat, a railroad whistle, a train whistle that has Mickey and Minnie on it. Mm-hmm. Nothing Can Stop Us Now is the song from the ride, and there's a shirt with that. There's a shirt with the ride logo. There's a pass holder shirt, pass holder magic band. There's a train toy model, and I think they missed the boat a little on this train toy model. I think they should have made it so that it could run on the same railroad as the Walt Disney World Railroad, the toy one.
Okay.
So you could run that and the railroad and your monorail. Mm-hmm. And then they have wishables, including Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse in their little car, and Goofy and Pluto. And they have this really cool pair of ears that's actually the old-fashioned mini hats from the 1930s on the ears. The little round hat with the flowers sticking out of it. And then there's a little bird in there called Chubby, and they have a purse and plush. Got another set of ears that's a set of clear ears with Mickey on Minnie and discs on the inside of the ears that roll around and move when you move your head. And that's it's got a little train on the top on a spring, so you can go doing and make the train go back and forth.
There's another set of ears that you particularly are lusting after, right?
Right. Two of them, actually. There's an ornament by Costa Alavesos that looks like a train, and it's really cool. And then there is the Designer Collection Ear Hat by Kevin Rafferty. And it's called the Perfect Picnic Light-Up Ear Hat. And it's got train tracks across the front and the little train over your left eye, fireworks on the ears, and then Mickey and Minnie picnicking on the top. Mickey's playing a ukulele for Minnie, who's dancing.
And I love that Kevin himself did this.
Well, Perfect Picnic. You know what Perfect Picnic? It's the name of the short that you're going into on the ride.
I'm just thrilled for Kevin that this attraction has gotten such a strong response already. And it was, you know, it was particularly exciting that even before this thing opened, plans were announced to bring a clone to Disneyland in 2022.
Yeah, if it's got Kevin Rafferty's name on it, it's quality.
Downside is Kevin won't be building or won't be in charge of the one that's going into Mickey's Toontown in Anaheim because he's retiring, right?
Yeah.
And
what a bummer.
I wish he'd put in some time on the Disneyland version because, remember, he actually started off his career with the company at Disneyland. He was a dishwasher. And then over time, he worked his way up to being the assistant manager of Club 33. And And, you know, which again is a highly sought after position at that resort. But then, as Kevin tells the story, he saw a sign that said, Mickey wants you. They were recruiting folks to help the Walt Disney Company, you know, complete Epcot in time for its opening in October of 1982. So applied and went over to WED in 1977 and to this day talks about the fact that he had to take a pay cut. You know, he was making $5 an hour as the assistant manager of, you know, Club 33, which back in 1977 was very good dough. But yeah, he had to take a step down to then basically do an entry level in Imagineering where he matted and dry matted concept art that the Imagineers were working on for future attractions to the park. And at some point, you know, he's still out there talking about his book, Magic Journey. You know, at some point we're going to have to buttonhole him and get him to talk about whether or not while he was at Imagineering, if he ever saw any concept art for that black hole ride. The, you know, do you remember when they were talking about doing that for Tomorrowland? It was, in a weird sort of way, it was the first try at Buzz Lightyear Space Ranger Spin, in that it was a shooter. You were supposed to go through the Cygnus and battle all of the evil robots. And Black Hole came out in December of 1979, and the film itself cost $17 million to make. It only made worldwide $35 million.
Oh boy!
So these days, whenever people talk about the Black Hole, they sort of see it as Disney's attempt to cash in on Star Wars, which of course came out. The original one, New Hope, arrived in theaters in May of 77. But that's not true. It actually, you know, what's weird about the Black Hole is that it actually started off life as Disney's answer to, the Poseidon Adventure in Towering Inferno. It was actually supposed to be a family-friendly disaster movie, if you can believe it.
Well, it was a disaster, all right.
Aha! Well, okay, tell us the story properly, folks. We've got to go all the way back to the early 1970s. And at this point, Walt Disney Productions hasn't really had a hit since, The Love Bug came out, or went into wide release in March of 1969. By December of 72, it was really obvious that Disney was kind of out of step with what was going on in the movie marketplace. That holiday season, Disney put into theaters a lightweight Dean Jones comedy, The Snowball Express, whereas 20th Century Fox, and why is that name significant? The 20th Century Fox releases a disaster movie, The Poseidon Adventure, only cost $4.7 million to make and would eventually go on to sell $75 million worth of tickets worldwide, which, if you adjust for inflation, is $462 million and $220. On the other hand, Snowball Express only made $6 million at the box office, which barely covered the cost of making, releasing, and then promoting this Dean Jones movie. And here's Disney looking on as 20th Century Fox follows up Poseidon Adventure by teaming with Warner Brothers to make The Towering Inferno, which costs a little bit more to make. It's $14 million versus the $4.7 million that it costs to make Poseidon Adventure. But on the other hand, when it's released to theaters, it makes $91 million, which, again, if we're playing the adjusted for inflation game, that's $561 million and $220. Or, excuse me, $2,020. And, of course, you know, that this will kind of resonate with you, Michelle. What does Disney put in theaters for December of 74? But Islands at the Top of the World,
yes.
Which, the studio really had hoped was going to be a hit because, you know, that would have led to
Discovery Bay, what
people had really hoped would save the parks, give Disneyland this amazingly immersive new land. Was it your engagement gift to me that you bought that they made prints of
Tony Baxter's picture of Discovery Bay.
Yeah, I think I still have that somewhere in the basement. It's a beautiful piece, but that movie cost $8 million to make and only made $10 million at the box office. So, and this is the thing, that this drove Winston Hibbler crazy. Winston is a guy who started at Disney back in 1942. He rose up through the ranks at the studio. You probably know his name from the True Life Adventure movies. He made a couple of the ones that won Academy Awards, The Living Desert, Vanishing Prairie, and White Wilderness. Again, he was there at Walt's elbow when, you know, Disney made movies that gave, you know, other studios in Hollywood a real run for their money. And, you know, and he was like, you know, we can still be in this business. We can still compete with, you know, the Warner Brothers in the 20th, you know, centuries of the world. And in fact, he went to Ron Miller and said, look, disaster movies are in right now. And I think I have an idea for a family-friendly disaster movie. And, you know your Ron Miller history, Michelle. I mean, he was equally frustrated that Disney was so out of step with what was going on in Hollywood and, you know, the 1970s.
Yep.
And so he, of course, you know, he listened to Winston's pitch. He loved it. And so, you know, he immediately, you know, puts this thing into development. So what's interesting is if we open the Walt Disney Productions annual report for 1974, we have a description of this then still in development disaster movie. And what it says is, Winston Hibbler has begun work on the next epic adventure to be filmed at Disney Studios, Space Station 1.
Not X1.
Set it, not X1, Space Station 1. And it's set in the year 2016. And this project calls for the far-off year of 2016. But it will call for the organization's talent in special effects to capture the perils of a sophisticated space station which is virtually torn apart by a supernova shock and then drawn into a black hole in space.
Torn apart by what?
A supernova.
Supernova.
You know, which I think I actually owned one of those. After my Ford Pinto. According to the research I've done, supernova is basically the same thing as a supernova, which is an explosion caused by the collapse of a dying star, hugely destructive event. Hibbler spends the next year or so developing this family-friendly disaster film for Disney, and which again is supposed to make Disney competitive with 20th Century Fox. Again, that name. What about that name? And Warner Brothers, with the idea that they, you know, this will then be Disney's Poseidon Adventure, Disney's Towering Inferno. And make no mistake, folks, the executives at Walt Disney Productions back in the mid-1970s were obsessed with those two movies. How do I know? When the studio went to go make Pete's Dragon, which was Disney's first big live-action movie musical since Bedknobs and Broomsticks, that was released to theaters in December of 71, who did they hire to write the music? Not Disney's old standbys, Richard B. and Robert M. Sherman. I mean, yeah, Academy Award winners. Those guys are losers. Who do they go with? The songwriting team of Al Kasha and Joel Hershon. Now, you probably don't know those names, but the reason Disney hired Kasha and Hershon to write songs for Pete's Dragon, this was back in October of 75, the reason they did that was because Al and Joel had first written There's Got to Be a Morning After, that's the Academy Award-winning theme song to the Poseidon Adventure, and then Kasha and Hershon went on to write We May Never Love Like This Again. Boy, if there was ever a song title for the 1970s. But anyway, We May Never Love Like This Again, which would, believe it or not, was the Academy Award-winning theme song for The Towering Inferno. Now this story, I swear to God, it's going to take a weird turn, but seriously, this actually happened. It turns out Al and Joel were supposedly two very superstitious guys. So much so Because they wanted to keep their streak of Academy Award-winning songs going, Kesha and Hirshhorn decided that at least one number that they wrote for Pete's Dragon would have to reference their earlier hit films, the two disaster movies they worked on, The Poseidon Adventure and The Towering Inferno. Which brings us now to Candle on the Water, which, by the way, did actually get nominated for Best Song at the 50th Academy Awards in 1977. It only to lose that year's Oscar to You Light Up My Life.
Talk about your 1970s song titles.
Yeah. But here's the thing. When us civilians listen to Candle on the Water, what do you think of? Helen Reddy, she's up there singing in the lighthouse. But when Al Kesha and Joel Hirshhorn, what they heard whenever they heard that song played, they first heard a reference to the Towering Inferno, a candle, which is what a tall building looks like when it's on fire.
Oh, dear.
And then a reference to the Poseidon Adventure, as in water, because that movie features a giant ocean liner that that capsizes when it's hit by a rogue wave out in the open water. I swear to God, folks, this is a true story. If you don't believe me, go out and pick up a copy of Al Kesha's memoir, Reaching the Morning After, which Nelson Incorporated published back in 1986. And this is where Kesha initially shared the secret meaning of Candle on the Water. So they're working on the score, starting in October of 1975. Meanwhile, Winston Hibler is chugging away on family-friendly disaster film, Space Station 1. So in a report comes out tail end of 1975, it now mentions Space Station 1 is in long-range planning for production in 1977, will be the most ambitious live-action feature the studio shot to date, truly fantastic science fiction story, co-produced by Winston Hibler. An incredible robot joins the daring rescue of the personnel aboard a doomed Earth station, which is steadily being drawn into a black hole in space. And once again, they go, the film will provide a special challenge to the studio's talented special effects department. I love that line, in the description of a black hole in space, as opposed to those pesky black holes that pop up in the kitchen.
Right.
In the hallway. Sorry.
There's an aurora borealis in your kitchen. May I see it?
Ghostbusters, right?
No, Simpson.
Oh, that's right. The ham.
The steam hams.
Oh, there we go. Yes. Skinner. Okay. All right. Anyway, but again, the part that breaks my heart here is the plan for production in 77. And as we mentioned at the top of the story, that Star Wars came out in May of 77. And this now meant that if they had stuck to the original schedule, Black Hole would have come out, the following, in 1978, and couldn't help escape being seen as a Star Wars ripoff. But the part of the story that just fascinates me is that Disney could have had Star Wars. April of 1973, George Lucas actually brings his 13-page treatment for what it is known at that time as the Star Wars. This great book called Carrie Fisher and Debbie Reynolds, Princess Leia and the Unsinkable Tammy in Hell, written by Darwin Porter. Where they share a quote from an interview that George Lucas did at one point, and he talks about bringing this pitch to Disney, and he says, "I won't say those Disney executives tossed me out of my ass, but they did show me the door very quickly." And so Disney had the chance, to have Star Wars in April of 1973, but they let it slip through their fingers. Meanwhile, thanks to Alan Ladd Jr., the then head of 20th Century Fox, again, that name, George got the money he needed to make A New Hope. And by March of 1976, he's out in the desert of Tunisia, shooting scenes that are set in Tatooine, where his space station won. That project suffers a huge setback in August of 1976, and because Winston Hibler, the veteran Disney producer who dreamed up this whole family-friendly disaster film, he dies at the age of 65. It's at this point that Space Station 1 really starts to go off track. You know, of course, when, Star Wars finally comes out, everyone in Hollywood, including Disney, is like, how do I get me one of them? And that's the thing, that Disney doesn't, you know, and they've got Space Station 1, you know, that they've got, this project that Winston did all this work on. So, you know, they continue working on it. They bring his son Christopher in, Christopher Hibbler, to co-produce. They also hire Jeb Rosebrook, who, you know, up until this point, Jeb's professional career as a writer is that he's done 4 episodes of The Walt. So, of course, he's the perfect guy to come in and work on a science fiction fantasy film. And it gets worse because, of course, Disney is looking at Star Wars, you know, and all the money they're making off of the toys. And remember how in the initial description of this project, it was one heroic robot. You know, if you look at Star Wars, there's all sorts of robots and there's all sorts of ships. And suddenly this film really starts to get distorted. You know, in fact, supposedly, it's not just make it more like Star Wars, but also Jeb's getting notes to the effect of make this something that will actually fit in with the Disney library. You know, make it more like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. So it's now 20,000 Leagues Up in Space. And so, you know, now the name of the project changes. It goes from Space Station 1 to Space Probe. Because, of course, Space Probe sounds like Star Wars.
And Space Probe Space Probe is in Space Mountain.
Okay, we'll fold that into the mix here. I think the thing particularly kind of doomed Black Hole was that at some point Disney realized that, well, wait a minute, if we make it too obviously a ripoff of Star Wars, people will hammer on us for that. So let's fold in a good chunk of 2001 A Space Odyssey, which brings us to the end of the movie, which is set up literally like, okay, we're 2 minutes into the movie and they put up a hologram of the black hole and Ernest Borgnine's Harry Booth character has one of the worst descriptive lines in the history of Hollywood. It's like, wow, right out of Dante's Inferno. And that line is in there to set up the end of the movie, which, if you remember, the imagery is very religious for a Disney film. There's that moment where you get to see Maximilian Schell's Dr. Hans Reinhardt character. He's effectively in hell, you know, surrounded by flame and dark minions. And then they transition basically to a set of stained windows, with an angel superimposed flying through these things. And yet the end that was supposed to pay off all of this, Disney tested and got such a bad response in previews, they cut it out of the movie. Have you heard about this, Michelle?
Yeah, you told me yesterday, but no, please.
Okay.
Tell them.
All right.
I still don't believe it.
Okay, here's the setup. Okay, all right. How many of you folks are familiar with, Michelangelo's The Sistine Chapel? In particular, the fresco, The Creation of Adam. It's perhaps the most famous image out of the Sistine Chapel.
It shows the Sistine ceiling.
There we go. The ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. So this fresco depicts the hands of God and Adam nearly touching. You know, and so if you remember the end of the black hole, toward the very end of this massive effect scene, you see the probe ship flying into this bright white space. And what was then supposed to happen is, this probe ship basically disappears, but you're looking at this bright white space, but the camera begins to pull back and pull back and pull back. And then you notice these two images coming in from in the side of that white void. And as the camera continues to pull out, you realize, oh my God, that's the finger of God and the hand of Adam. And it pulls out and you're suddenly looking at the fresco in the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. And then eventually the camera drops to the floor of the chapel, and who's looking up at the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, but Yvette Menu's Kate McRae character, and you know and then it's over. I mean, that was the end of the movie, and you know the lights came up, and as I understand it, at the test screening, the audience damn near rioted because it's like, what? There were robots. There were. They're flying meteors. How were we in the Sistine Chapel? And it's like, okay, we need a new ending. Anyway, we were talking earlier about, you know, Disney spent $17 million to make this, which was huge money. You know, back in 79, the original Star Wars, you know, only cost $11 million. And, you know, Black Hole makes $35.8 million worldwide. Whereas the original Star Wars makes $410 million, you know, worldwide, which is the equivalent of $1.2 billion today. Honestly, the only people who ever made any money off of the Black Hole were the people who bought the toys, and oh, were there toys, Michelle. There were lunchboxes, there were action figures, calendars, there were models of the Cygnus, the Crystal Palace-like ship, and Vincent, the little, you know, R2-D2-like flying robot that was voiced by Roddy McDowall. Long story short, these things did not sell in 79, so there were a lot of toy collectors who bought these things on 10 cents and a dollar when they were being remaindered. And they're now, if you go over to eBay right now, these Black Hole toys, individual action figures, are selling for $250 a piece. So to kind of bring this full circle, maybe you should go buy, you know, that Disney Wisdom stuff. Guys, who knows? 40 years from now, you know, there may be somebody who needs a stackable mug. Anyway, long story short, folks, if you like these sorts of behind-the-scenes stories about the Walt Disney Company, you need to know that Michelle and I, along with Dustin Fuse, are teaming up with Storybook Destination, the travel agency that it helps with Jim Hill Media stage all of its previous live events. We're doing another get-together this November. So please mark your calendars for November 13th through the 16th, which is when we're going to be doing, God help us, Jim's Disney Spring Thing.
I love it.
You know, I don't know about that name. Anyway, this weekend-long event will feature trivia contests and scavenger hunts, not to mention a visit to the Disney West Side to catch a performance of Drawn to Life, the new Cirque du Soleil all Disney-centric show, which begins previews later this month on March 20th, to be exact. We'll be talking about the history of the late great Pleasure Island, which Michelle and I were very friendly with the cast of that show. In fact, there was a member of the prominent member of the opening cast of the Adventurers Club, who actually made an appearance at the hospital the day Alice was born. Do you want to share that story?
Leslie Carrera, who's now Leslie Carrera Rudolph, Wop Frog, was...
You might know that name, by the way, folks, if you were a fan of Sesame Street, because she's the very talented performer behind Abby Cadabby, the Sesame Street Muppet that, what, is a fairy in training?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. You were telling this story.
Okay. Well, a week earlier, she had come and thrown me a baby shower in the hospital because I had some complications, and brought me presents from each of the Adventurers Club members, supposedly. The butler sent a white glove with little bells on the fingers. And Hathaway Brown sent a small model airplane. It was really cute. A little handmade airplane. So she came back just to visit, and it turns out that at that point, I was heavy labor.
Yeah. In fact, to set the scene properly here, as Leslie pokes her head into Michelle's a hospital room, I'm holding one leg. Michelle's mom, Nancy Smith, is holding the other leg, and Alice is getting ready to make her debut. So again, continue the story.
she decides that she's going to help. So she gets up on a table and starts jumping up and down and yelling, push her out, way out, until Alice is born. Then she's going to be late for work, so she yells at Alice that she's covered with library paste, and then she leaves.
And then, again, we were terrible parents. We would bring our newborn to the Adventurers Club, but we wouldn't actually be in the club. We'd be down, down at the very bottom of the stairs.
Under the stairs was a little carpeted area. After we moved away, they took up the carpet, but it used to be carpeted down there, and it was a little quiet and kind of aside from everything.
This was also where the cast members would come and go, going backstage. You know, for example,
the door to the green
what
room.
What is it? Yeah, and what was funny is that they would grab Alice out of our hands and cuddle with her down there in the alcove, and then suddenly, oh, I got to go on stage, and suddenly become Otis Wren or suddenly become Dusty Cabinets. And I guess
one night when we were sitting down there, someone else came to visit us.
That's right. That's right. This is Joe Rohde. And Joe was bringing folks into the Adventurers Club. In fact, it was kind of an interesting moment because he was literally pointing to things in the club like, that's mine. I put this in here. I found that in, you know, at Sumatra. But he then sees us with the cast and he sees us with Alice. And he comes over and just picks up Alice. And I guess because his own son
was about 9 months old at the time, and Alice was about 5 months.
Yeah, and it was one of these things. It was like, oh, I need a baby fix. Aww. I haven't seen my son in so long. And
he was working on Animal Kingdom.
You know, but again, it was there was a whole club full of drinking and carousing, but down here was this little quiet corner full of touchy-feely actors and creative types who... You miss babies. And so, yeah, we lost our shirt. Yeah, we had a very weird connection with the cast of the Adventurers Club. But we'll get to that at this event in November. Not only that, we will talk about Disney Boardwalk, the original version of Disney Boardwalk, with the Imagineers originally planned to be basically Pleasure Island 2, right? It was going to be a nighttime entertainment district with a...
It was. And they'll hear my story about when I took a boat out on Crescent Lake to sunbathe.
Okay. We'll save that one. Anyway, these are the sorts of stories you'll get to hear, folks, if you participate in our next live event, again, this November. Guarantee it'll be a fun time, and if you want to get in on that fun, please drop Tammy Whiting a line at DisneyDish@StorybookDestinations.com, and then let her know you're interested in taking part in this year's event. Once we firm up details as to actually what we're doing come November, Ms. Whiting will be back in touch. But if people can't wait till that point to hear more of your stories, Michelle. Where else can they find you online?
I do rumor control on MiceChat.com, and I have the Pink Monorail podcast with our daughter, Alice.
Talented girl. Okay, we have, on this side of the fence, we have Disney's with Glenn Testa. We have Fine Tuning with Drew Taylor. We have Universal Joint with Dustin Hughes, who will also be taking part with us in the event in November. We have... Looking at Lucasfilm with Dan Z, and let's not forget about Marvel Us Disney with Aaron Adams, a gentleman who edits a lot of the podcasts here at the Jim Hill Media Podcast Network. Tell you what, folks, if you could do Michelle and I a favor, if you could head over to iTunes and rate and recommend the show, we'd really, really appreciate that. That gets us extra eyeballs and ears. And if you particularly enjoyed what you heard today, if you could head over to Bandcamp and subscribe, that's what helps us, pay for those $79 Cinderella carriage deluxe gift play sets. Okay, man. Anyway, social media. We have a social media presence. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Instagram as Jim Hill Media. Over on Facebook, for some reason, we're Jim Hill Media News. We look forward to chatting again with folks. So we should be back with a brand new episode of I Want That in 2 weeks' time. So till then, happy shopping.